I'm now joined with Fiona Murdoch to talk about a book she had written 20 years ago entitled Victor Bewley's Memoirs. It has just been republished and is based on interviews she had with Victor, who was actually her grandfather, a few years before his death in 1999. Good afternoon, Fiona. Thank you for joining us.
Good afternoon, Johnny. Thanks for inviting me.
You're most welcome. Fiona, Victor became director of Bewley's Cafe at the age of only 20, and the following year, in 1932, their managing director, the position held by his father and grandfather before him. Fiona, I believe there was a lot more to Victor's life than just running cafes for 45 years. Would you like to tell us more about this and what kind of man he was?
He was a very sensitive and thoughtful and generous man. He was very interested in people, far more interested in people than making profit. He didn't consider himself a natural businessman. Although he was always interested in hearing about the cafes when he was growing up, it wasn't any particular ambition of him to become involved in the business, but he knew from a young age, as the eldest son, it was expected of him. His interests were more along the lines of art, and he did paint throughout his life. He loved playing the piano. He had dreams of being a concert pianist, but obviously realised he didn't actually have the talent to do that, but it was something he enjoyed doing. And he was interested in missionary work in the sort of broadest sense of helping people who were underprivileged and helping alleviate suffering and poverty, I suppose. Interestingly, he did manage to pursue all his interests in one way or another throughout his life. He did an exceptional amount of voluntary work, particularly with travellers. He also initiated cross-border reconciliation talks. On one occasion, he even brought a secret message from the IRA to the British government in the hopes of bringing about peace on this island. And even in his work in the cafes, he very much brought his Christian perspective. He felt very strongly that the shares shouldn't just be held by members of the family, that all long-term members of staff should have a say in the running of the business. So, and he actually told me when I was talking to him towards the end of his life that he saw the setting up of the Bewley community in 1972, as probably the most important thing he did in his life. And at that point, in 1972, and his two brothers, Alfred and Joe, who at that time were also directors, they decided to hand the shares of the business over to all members of staff who had been there for 3 years or longer. And it wasn't just about money, because there never were big profits made, but it was about giving the staff an opportunity to take part in decision making. And then they had a say. Well, there was an equal distribution of half of the profits among the members of the Bewley community, and then half always went to charity, and all members of staff could make suggestions as to, they decided which charities to support.
Okay, and from that point, actually, he also dedicated a lot of time and energy into improving people's lives, but especially travellers. Tell us a bit more about that.
That's right. He was always interested in travellers. He grew up on what was the Bewley Farm in Rathgar, which was in the countryside at that time. So where high school now stands, that was the Bewley Farm. His father bought that that land in 1900. And Grandad remembered as a boy that sometimes the far side of the River Dodder, he would sometimes see traveller families camping there. And he was always very intrigued with their, what seemed like a simple and colourful way of life. So even as a boy, he had an interest in finding out about them and what their way of life was like. But this didn't actually happen until the 1960s. A government report was issued which they had done a survey of travellers living in Ireland, which discovered that the majority of travellers wanted to settle. And he was interested in this, but still wasn't involved at that stage. But a few years later, when he was driving to work one day through Inchicore, he saw some travellers camped at the side of the road who were being moved on by Gardaí. And he was concerned about this, knowing that they would probably be moved on again wherever they ended up. And then in 1964, he was involved in Quakers, and Quakers were approached and asked to support a school for travellers in Cherry Orchard. And at that point, he and his brother Alfred visited the site near Ballyfermot, I think. And on that occasion, so they saw the conditions that the traveller families were living in. Some would just have been sleeping on straw on the ground. Like, some had makeshift shelters just made with packing cases. And on that occasion, he also visiting was Lady Eleanor Wicklow and Father Thomas Feely, who later became Monsignor Thomas Feely. And at that point, they set up a committee to liaise with travellers, to talk to them about what they wanted, and to try and help win the support of public opinion for the provision of halting sites and accommodation for travellers, not only in Dublin. Well, it started up off as a Dublin committee, but then within a couple of years, it became the National Council for Travelling People. And so Grandad would have spent much time travelling around the country, talking to communities, talking to travellers, trying to find a way that halting sites could be set up. And in 1974, Grandad was actually appointed to be an advisor to the government on the settlement of travellers. He was still working at that stage, so I think he did maybe 2 days a week with travellers and then 3 days a week in the business. And then he retired in 1977, and he continued then a few days a week to work on around the issue of travellers. He was a remarkable man. I mean, he was sensitive. He said he suffered shyness throughout his life. He always had a fear of walking into a room full of people, meeting big groups of people. And yet there he was going around, driving around the country, meeting different groups. And you can imagine a lot of these community meetings, there would have been a lot of opposition to travellers settling in areas. But he felt so convinced about the work and about what he was doing. He wanted to do whatever he could to help. And remarkably, this time now, he was living up the mountains on a small farm because he tried to be as self-sufficient as possible, growing fruit and veg for the family. They had a few cows and some hens, 30 acres of land near Britis, County Dublin. And in the 1960s, he actually invited several travellers to come and live on the land. So it's not like he was just travelling around the country telling other people that they should have travellers living near them. But he actually himself had invited four traveller families who stayed a few years. And the only reason they moved on when they did was because they found it a bit isolated where they were. And so he really believed in acting out his faith, I suppose.
Absolutely, yeah. Actually, one section of the book is dedicated to Victor's faith and spirituality. Would that be right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you briefly touched on this earlier. He also initiated cross-border reconciliation talks with loyalists and Republicans.
That's right. Yeah. Yes.
What was your grandfather's belief behind handing over the business to staff in 72? I know you mentioned it earlier, but I mean, in terms of, you know, the employees sharing the profits with half going to charity, that surely explains that to him, profit meant nothing. It was more about giving.
Yeah, he was only really interested in taking a living wage, a wage that, you know, he needed to support his family. He was never interested in making a big profit. And a lot of people might think that Bewley's did make big profits, but he said they never did. There was only 2 years in which they made a loss during his time as managing director, and it was quite small. It was £10. I suppose when he took over, so in 1932, it was his father died, I think. I suppose Bewley's would have been seen as quite maybe a bit exclusive then. So Grandad was always keen on keeping prices down as much as possible and to, you know, so that it was as open to as many people as possible. But yeah, profit was the last thing that was of interest to him.
Yes, it's amazing.
He was brought up as a Quaker. So, Quaker is a nickname, but the Religious Society of Friends, which is a Christian denomination, but in some ways can appear quite different from the mainstream Christian churches in that we don't have ordained clergy. We all take an equal responsibility in the society. And there isn't a written creed as such, but we do have testimonies that we try to live to. And some of those would be things like peace and equality, simplicity. So as we can see through the work that Grandad did, he very much lived those out. So in equality, obviously, in terms of handing over the business to the employees, and simplicity in the way he lived his life. It's interesting because even though both his parents were Quakers, they were quite different in that. So Ernest, his father, was the one responsible for Grafton Street Bewley's. One of the last things he would have done in his last few years of life was to purchase Grafton Street and to do it out, to fit it very plushly. I mean, he would have been responsible for those, plush velvet booths and the lovely Harry Clark windows. That wouldn't have been Grandad's something he inherited. Ernest even drove a Bentley at a time when there probably weren't even that many cars in Dublin. That never interested Grandad at all. He didn't even like driving it. Sometimes he was asked to drive his father in it. But Grandad's mother came from a very different background in that her parents were missionaries in Madagascar. So she spent the first nine years of her life in Madagascar living quite a simple life, I presume. And so I think Grandad probably inherited the simplicity more from his mother. And then, I mean, and he grew up in a very nice house in Rathgar on the Bewley farm, Dainham. But and like they had servants. Now, they weren't called servants. They were called by name. But, you know, they had people preparing their meals and they had nannies and things. And as Grandad grew older, he thought he just didn't agree with the differentials in society. So he made a decision to buy this land in the Dublin Mountains and build quite a small, modest bungalow for him and his family, because that was the way he wanted to live his life. And
all right. By the way, what year was Bewley's Cafe formed? 1840-something?
So in the 1840s, Joshua, who would have been Victor's grandfather, Joshua started selling mainly tea and sugar in a premises on Sycamore Street off Dame Street. And he sold a little bit of coffee and some oriental vases and ornaments. I'm not quite sure why that came about, but hence the name Bewley's Oriental Cafes for a number of years. And then Ernest, so Victor's father, then started in the business in 1876. So Georgia Street would have been the first Bewley's Cafe as we would know it. And Ernest started selling coffee then and giving kind of coffee making demonstrations in Georgia Street. So his and his wife, his first wife, Bertha, made rolls and scones. So that's kind of how the cafe started. So that was Georgia Street. And then in 1896, Westmoreland Street was bought and opened as a shop and cafe. And then Grafton Street was the last to come about in 1927. And then it wasn't until some of Victor's nephews and Victor's daughter, Rachel, my aunt, became involved in the business, then they started going into the suburbs, so Dundrum, Stillorgan, Blackrock.
Fiona, tell us a bit about your own memories of Bewley's itself when you were growing up.
I grew up in Rathgar, not that far from where the farm was, and we would have gone into town, into the city centre, maybe once or twice a year. And I have very fond memories of going to Bewley's, sometimes West Warner Street and sometimes it would be Grafton Street. Just very warm, nostalgic memories, and just enjoying in particular the almond buns and the Mary cakes. And then what was very special for us was after we'd finish our cake or lunch or whatever we were having, we would follow Mum up the stairs, myself and my brother and sister, to visit Grandad in his office. It always just felt like such a perk. It always felt, oh, we're so grand, we get to go upstairs and meet the boss. How busy Grandad might have been, he was always very warm and welcoming and would listen to our excited prattle as we sat in his armchair. So that was, yeah, very nice. And then I have very fond memories then of going and visiting my granny and granddad on their farm, and inevitably there would be lovely spreads of Bewley's fare, chocolate fudge cake, almond ring, etc., cherry log. And the funny thing is, I was really excited one summer when we were going there for a week, just myself and my brother and sister, and I thought, oh, we're going to eat so much cake and buns every night. And I was really shocked to discover they actually ate quite simply normally. It was just usually the Bewley, if we were going out for one meal, then Grandad would have brought home some of the goods from the bakery. But they didn't normally, I discovered then, they didn't normally eat like that at all.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, speaking of Bewley's, you know, the smell of the coffee when you walk in is as good as drinking it.
I know. And very to special. Be honest, yeah. I don't even drink coffee, but I love the smell of it. My sister doesn't drink coffee either. But yeah.
Apart from the business, if you don't mind me asking, what are your personal memories of Victor as a granddad?
Well, at family occasions, he would be very quiet, actually. But he really, I mean, there was always a sense of warmth and interest from him. But he was never somebody to put himself forward. And usually it's the women in our family who do most of the talking. So he would always have asked us questions and wanted to hear you know, what was, you know, what were our latest interests were. But of course, we were interested, and we did ask him about the cafes, and he would always tell us anything we wanted to know. But yeah, I mean, my favourite, I think visits to the farm, actually, and staying with them and just pottering around the farm with them and watching him milk the cows. And also he had a cottage in the west of Ireland, which we stayed with him a couple of times, and we have very fond memories then of beaches and picnics and trips out in the boat to catch mackerel. And he was really happiest, I think, in nature and in the countryside, living quite a simple life, really. And actually, I would have chatted a lot more to my grandmother. Now, Granny actually died when I was at college, so then. Obviously I really missed her, but one benefit that we did have as a result is that I got to talk to Grandad a lot more. And then after he retired, actually, my mum, or actually a number of us, said to him, "Have you thought of writing your memoirs? They'd be really interesting." And I can hear him now still just chuckling and saying, who on earth would want to read my memoirs? We were feeling sad that he never had committed to paper any of, well, his interesting life. So I cautiously asked him again. I said, "Grandad, would you be willing to talk to me? Would you mind if I wrote a record of your life?" My mum actually had suggested it, and she wasn't thinking in terms of publication. She was literally thinking in terms of the family, as a record for the family. And I was really astounded when he agreed, actually. Yeah. And was happy for me to go to a publisher. In fact, Veritas, who published the book, they had published a book of his about traveling people in the 1970s. So he said to go to them first. And when I did find, when I did get around to approaching them, I got a phone call 2 days later saying, "Yes, we'd like to publish your grandfather's memoirs." And he was such an articulate man that it was so easy to compile the book, because he really thought before he spoke. And I know from having worked as a journalist and transcribed many interviews over the years, most people don't talk currently, including myself. Often we start, he really thought before he spoke. And he had experience of doing a lot of media interviews with his work for Travellers, and difficult, challenging media interviews as well. So yeah, it was easy to do. Like, I literally just had to type up the words and make them into paragraphs and add some commas and full stops. It was a privilege to do it, to be honest.
Oh, I'd say so. Fair play to you. Finally, Fiona, tell us, how can anyone get a hold of the new book?
Okay, well, it's published by Veritas, so it's available on the Veritas website. I did see it also on Bookstation, and you know what they say, any good bookshop should be stocking it, or should be able to order it for you if they don't actually have it on their shelves.
Right,
oh, sorry, I should also say, thankfully, Campbell's, who now own Bewley's, of course, since 1986, it hasn't been in the family since 1986, Campbell's are going to stock it in Bewley's and Grafton Street, so people can look out for it there as well.
Excellent, that sounds great. Right, so we leave it there for today. Thanks again, Fiona, for joining
us.
Thanks, Johnny. It was lovely talking with you, and good luck with the book, and all the very best to you. Do take care.
Thanks very much, Johnny. Take care.
You're most welcome. Now, that was Fiona Murdoch talking about a book she had written 20 years ago entitled Victor Bewley's Memoirs. It has just been republished and is based on interviews she had with Victor, who is, in fact, her grandfather, and that was a few years before his death in 1999.